Okay, today I'm going to talk about the application of the MCDH to the strong field phenomena. So this work is done with Thomas Babas from University of Ottawa and Misha.
I don't think the microphone is on.
Yeah, the guy just came up and said it is on.
Principally,
we are sure.
It is not.
Can you just speak a little bit louder?
Okay.
But maybe isn't there not a switch in his pocket or something?
There is a switch.
You won't hear it.
It's okay. Okay. So firstly, about the motivation of our talk, what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to study the strong field dynamics and partially the role of the electron correlation, a multi-electron correlation in the processes of the in a strong laser field. So nowadays, principally, the strong field phenomena, for example, harmonic generation, is well understood within so-called three-step model, where the whole dynamics in the field is split into the three parts, three steps. And the first one is the tunnel ionization of the weakest bound electron by the laser field. Then the second acceleration in the field, and the field push the electron back to the parent ion. In the last step, the recombination can occur, where the high harmonics of the field may be generated. So in this three-step model, the whole dynamics, it is assumed that only one of the electrons interacts with the laser field. So the state of the other electrons, so principally I have here put the two-electron system, but it can be multi-electron system. The state of all other electrons is assumed to be frozen in an ion. So in a ground state of the ion, principally. So, of course, this approximation may be quite okay. It is assumed that the field intensities are not high enough so that the double or multiple ionizations are not so pronounced. So only single ionization can happen, and maybe we can describe the influence of the electric field only on one electron. But principally, even in this such a relative weak fields, the electron correlation may occur, which will lead to the population of the quantum mechanically to the population of these higher states of this ion. So, in other words, the correlation. So, in this talk, I'm going to analyze the role of these high populated ionic states, in other words, the electron correlation, in a strong field dynamics. And by this way, they analyze the accuracy of the single active electron approximation. It's very important because all the theoretical and experimental studies mainly uses this approximation, and especially in a very modern topic as the reconstruction of molecular orbitals, it's widely used. So it's a question, how big is the role of these electron excitations? So for this purpose, I will choose a model system consisting of the two electrons and start to solve the quantum mechanical dynamics exactly in this system. This is the two electron system, each electron described in a two dimension. So and by this way, we'll see how much is the role of these excited ionic states, and we can appreciate it, we can understand it, and see what's the dependence of these excitations, if they exist, on the different parameters, which is the laser intensity, laser pulse duration, quantum mechanical states, etc., etc. And by this way, we can appreciate this the same effect for the realistic three-dimensional multi-electron systems. So. So well, I'm going to introduce the application of multi-configuration time-dependent Hartree method. It's a numerical method for the propagation of the wave packets for the diatom with two electrons in two dimensions each. And after it.
Just a question: why in each electron in two dimensions?
Because this is only the I think what you which we can study on a single processor machines. So two dimensions.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, sure.
But normally, if you run something like this, these codes, then you can actually get away with one dimension because angular parts, they solve analytically. What you are solving is the radial part, and radial part for each electron is just one dimension.
Yes, it is assumed that the electric field is linearly polarized. Yes. It is. We can solve the. We can extract the whole physics taking only one dimension. Uh-huh. But you want to study also the dynamics in diatom. So diatom dependence on the molecular orientation.
Oh, I see. So there is no spherical symmetry and. Okay.
No. So we have to take minimum 2 degrees of freedom per electron to study it. 3 is too much.
This with anti-symmetrization or not?
Sure.
Why is it time-dependent Hartree and not time-dependent Hartree 5?
Well, I'll talk about it later.
Should be Hartree 4.
It is included everything. I will talk about the Hartree and Hartree 4, the dependence of it, later.
Actually, this is a question that everybody always asks. And I'm the first to ask this question always. But as you will see, it really is only the issue of how you choose the basis set.
I mean, having a local potential is easier than having a string.
Right, but as long as you properly symmetrize your wave function within the basis set that you choose, everything is fine. Just a comment, to your point. This is what is really fundamental here is that we've got two active electrons.
That's fine, but you have also two nuclei.
This makes life even more miserable. Uh-huh. But even if you only had one nucleus, like helium atom, uh-huh. with two electrons, and we were to look at two electron ionization, uh-huh. you cannot solve analytically the full angular momentum problem. All you can say in linearly polarized light and helium, all you can say is that the total M is conserved.
Yes,
but the coupling between different angular momentum.
If you have a spherically symmetric problem,
yeah.
angular momentum and its projections are conserved for good quantum numbers.
The only good quantum number in the presence of a strong laser field and two active electrons is the projection of total angular momentum on z axis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have a strong quantizing field. That's it. I understand.
Yeah. Just to clarify. When you say 2D each, that means you're solving the problem in a plane.
In a plane, yes. I'm choosing the
atom molecule, the electrons only move in a plane.
In a plane, yes. I'm choosing the soft core Coulomb potentials, so we can adjust the parameters, ionization potential, etc., to be close to the realistic molecule. So. Yeah, I continued. Then the strong field, I'll apply this strong field analysis of this system in the laser field. And we find out the role of the electron correlation, the role of the ionic high excited ionic states, and the origins, where they come from. And finally, I'll focus on the application harmonic generation to show the role of these excited ionic states, how they are. So. Firstly, the method, the multi-configuration time-dependent Hartree, briefly MCTDH, is a very powerful numerical method for the propagation of wave packets. It's developed during the past 15 years in Heidelberg, is reviewed in this paper. So, the main point here is the wave function. The wave function is split into the is represented in the basis of time-dependent wave function. So it is the normal wave function expansion, but the difference between the conventional basis expansion is that the basis functions are now time-dependent. So, because both the expansion coefficients and the basis functions are time dependent, now the equations of motion for both of them are derived from the variational principle. And here we have to choose constraints, because to fix the phase shift between these two, this will ensure that not only the wave function, but also the coefficients and the basis function will be uniquely defined. So the principle, the simple, say, the, we split our system into subsystems, which are called single particles. These single particles can be the real particles, but generally they are combination, arbitrary combination of degrees of freedom. Can be one dimensional or several dimensional. And all the correlation between this one particle is described exactly, but between the other different particles approximately. So the method is principal approximation, but choosing a relatively large number of the basis functions who can be close to the, very close to the exact result. So principally, this method is not an approximation. This is assumed that we do here close to the exact propagation. Yes?
The basis functions include the spin?
Here it's assumed that they can include the spin, they cannot include the spin. So principally, this method is designed for the nuclear dynamics, so they can include the spin.
Do you include the spin?
Sure, I'll talk about it later. Okay. Yes?
It is a theorem that Hartree-Fock, time-independent Hartree-Fock description is the best description still compatible with the notion of independent particles. Not non-interacting particles, but independent particles. As long as you can put a sticker on the label and say this is electron 1s, this is electron 2p, of course they interact. Mm-hmm. So you can actually derive Hartree-Fock equation from variational principle. Mm-hmm. But what about time-dependent Hartree-Fock? Are they still like independent particles, or this is the best description of independent particles?
This is surely one of the best descriptions in the particles, and they are not independent. They may interact with each other. And this correlation between single particles is covered by choosing a relatively large number of these Hartree expansions. So the more correlation we have, the more functions will be used.
So it's multi-configuration,
yeah.
Interaction, like correlations come into this.
Into this, this number, or yes, into this multi-configuration.
But even, this is something that maybe people here have some insight into it, but if you, in time-dependent, in the Fourier transform of time-dependent Hartree-Fock is not time-independent Hartree-Fock. So if you think about two electrons, let's say, you think about the total wave function as a product of two electrons, let's say in helium, and the two electrons are orbiting around the nucleus, but your wave function is still a product. The two electrons, even with a single configuration, you still have correlation in the time dependent, and the Fourier transform of that does not give you time independent. So the time dependent does build in some correlation even within a single configuration.
Now that's news to me.
Yeah, to me too.
I mean, it depends on how you define correlation, because standard definition is correlation are the interaction between the electrons that are go beyond those in the Hartree-Fock picture.
Beyond the product limit.
So, those people doing these calculations use that definition. Correlation is interactions between electrons that go beyond Hartree-Fock, and certainly Hartree-Fock includes interactions between the electrons, but that's not called correlation in the many-body perturbation theory community.
Yeah.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the Fourier transform of time dependent does not give you back time independent.
Yeah, but it is a product form.
It's a product form at every instant in time that the product form changes. So you can have a situation, let's say, where the two electrons actually move in a correlated way, that they feel each other.
They feel the mean field.
Yes, they feel the mean field, but they feel the instantaneous mean field, which is not the same as the average mean field.
Uh-huh, I see. So what you're saying, that the correlation may be from the time dependent.
Exactly. So we actually tried to work on this some time ago. We did not get very far with it. And apparently, I forgot what the acronym is, but there's something, this is equivalent to something that's known in, it's equivalent to some kind of approximation which is known, which gives you a little bit of correlation, but not very much. And that's unfortunate, because we were trying to
get a random phase approximation, right?
Time-dependent Hartree-Fock is random phase.
Time-dependent Hartree-Fock is random phase.
Right. And that does include correlations. That includes all particle-hole interactions.
Okay. So,
is it true?
No, random phase is a very particular approximation. It contains particle-hole excitations. Right. And multiple particle holes. But
those are correlations.
Those are correlations, of course, and they are dynamical correlations.
And I remember a paper that links time-dependent Hartree-Fock.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I also remember, actually in Amusia book, there is this connection. I also totally remember that.
Whose book is it?
Amusia, atomic polarization.
It's called atomic photo effect.
Okay. So, all right, so now everybody knows what, everybody knows this already, okay. But that means that in principle, one would hope that one could go, you know, at least some distance just with a single configuration in terms of getting correlation.
Sure. In fact, our random phase approximation is designed for systems that have ground state having spherical symmetry, which includes all closed shell atoms.
Not just spherical symmetry, not degenerate ground state.
Okay. Non-degenerate spherical symmetry, state zero ground state.
Like noble gases.
Although there's been generalizations to half filled shells that have non-zero spin.
Okay. So the main difference between the MCDH and the conventional Bayes expansion, as I said, is that the Bayes function are now time dependent. It means that they describe the dynamics of the system much better than if we had time independent Bayes. Actually, in other words, these Bayes functions, they move with the wave function together, and that's why we can describe our system, our dynamics, using much lower number of basis functions, as in the case of time independent basis sets. So that's why the method can be very efficient. So, but the price is that we have to solve quite a complicated set of coupled nonlinear differential equations for the coefficients and basis functions. So here nonlinearity is built here. This depends on quadratically on the phis, and here the density matrix and mean field matrix can contain the coefficient. So the main thing here is that if we increase the number of the expansion functions here in MCDH ansatz, our solution will monotonically converge to the exact numerically exact solutions can be mathematically proven. So the basis function become time independent, and we go to the standard approach in a representation of in a full basis set.
What does
WF
mean?
What?
MCTDHWF, second to last line.
Wave functions.
Second to last line.
Wave functions. Configuration time dependent Hartree wave function.
Wave function, sorry. Okay. So, yes, one of the main important thing here is the efficient integration of the equations of motion. So we have split our wave function into a basis set of the lower dimensional functions. This is very okay, but in the equations of motion, such in Hamiltonian terms, the multidimensional integrals appear, which must be calculated efficiently. It means that the Hamiltonian also is very desirable to represent in the same form as the wave function. And only then we can calculate this multidimensional integration very efficiently. It can be split into some of the product of one-dimensional integrations. So And that's why this is very important. Some other words, how convergence can be, convergence with respect to the number of basis functions can be obtained in MCDH. We can do it in normal manner. We can start another calculation with larger number of the basis functions and see how everything, our results changing. But it is also possible to appreciate everything by analyzing the natural orbitals, which are the density, which are the eigenvalues of the density operator. So they are now time dependent, because density operator is time dependent, and they have the ascending, descending order. By analyzing the least occupied natural orbital, we'll see as how good our basis represents the whole wave function. For example, here is the example of natural populations versus the propagation time, and we see that we are here in this calculation converged better than 10 to 2, yeah, 10 to minus 6 it should be, to this small value.
So then what you forgot to mention, I think it's really important to mention, that in this particular realization of the propagator, the wave functions, this phi, the orbitals, are chosen in one dimension.
No, I will tell about it. It's just the general method. Yes, please.
In other words, one way of choosing the orbitals is just, as you say, right, every electron is going to be treated as a full 3D wave function. Then I'm going to take the product of one electron function. But another way to do it is having to treat each degree of freedom. And so that's what you're doing here. You're treating each degree of freedom.
Yes. Okay. And this simply explains why we worried so much about calculating these multidimensional integrals and converting the Hamiltonian into a product of one dimension, into sum of the product of one dimensional functions.
Because this is already turning it a little bit into a discussion, but my thinking was the following, if you would deal with a full 3D particle wave function, that although you pay a heavy price because you have to do 3D calculations, the scaling is not bad because the scaling is still I don't know if it's quasi linear with the number of particles, at least with a simple time dependent heart rate.
Definitely not quasi linear.
It's not linear.
Yeah, not quasi linear.
I mean, you have n times n minus one particle interactions.
But the point is that suppose we only have one electron,
you actually have fewer interactions in that sense than if you do every degree of freedom separately, you pay a heavy price for each to do all the 3D calculations, but there at least there's some intuitive argument that the strongest correlations will be within those degrees of freedom that are internal to the same particle. And so by treating those correlations essentially exactly.
So you say that by splitting the coordinates of the one electron may appear the additional correlation between them. Yeah,
that doing the full 3D calculation or the full 2D calculation in your case for each particle is, although you pay a heavy price, you build in full correlation on that level of the particle degrees of freedom. And if you assume that that's where the heaviest correlations are within the degrees of freedom of a single particle. So again, with this image of two electrons orbiting around in helium, you're doing each electron essentially exactly as a one particle thing. And the approximation is that you have a product of those two. But this each electron now can have been some kind of distorted wave function. You're getting that exactly right. So that maybe that intuition is wrong, but that's how I thought about it. That it's natural to think about in physical terms of products of particle orbitals. And in fact, in Dirac's original paper on time dependent Hartree phi, that's how he also really presents it in terms of products of single particle orbitals.
Okay. Yes.
So this form of the Hamiltonian is a very unusual one, because usually you have a sum plus the interaction terms. Now you have products, I suppose products also of the derivatives. How many terms really do you need here?
So I'll tell talk about it later. So here is the whole Hamiltonian sphere is desirable to represent in this form. About how many terms I need for the column potential, I'll talk later. Okay. Okay. Now let's turn just about the applications. MCDH has a very wide range of applications. So post-decision absorption. So originally it is developed for the application of the nuclear dynamics. And also the surface scattering, reactive scattering can be treated. And recently, its Hartree-Fock analog appeared, especially for the applications of multi-electron systems in strong laser fields. So difference is here that the single particles here, these single particles correspond to the real electrons. And these basis functions, they are the spin orbitals of the one electron.
So who is doing this?
Originally it was doing Armin Skrentzin, but it is widely used in several groups in the world. So one of them, David Tanner's group. So in the application of the quantum control.
I think has been one of the big developers of that.
Okay. So here, depending on application, I say that for the few electron systems, in some applications, MCDH may be more efficient than Hartree-Fock. Here, I'm not talking about the bound state dynamics, which is included in a quantum control. So here, I'm talking about the real applications where the ionization may occur. So the grid dimension in each dimension for each coordinate is really very large, and the disadvantage of Hartree-Fock is that we deal here with three-dimensional or multi-dimensional wave functions. If we have more than one dimension per electron. So this is very, very complicated in integration, because this method can be very efficient. For example, if you have two electron systems, a helium atom, in Hartree-Fock we have two single particles each in 3D and very low number of configurations. The number of configurations is the cumulative index of this coefficient vector. And while in Hartree, MCDH can, the system can be represented in lots of variations. So we can split it into three particles in different ways, or four particles. In other words, we decrease the dimensionality of our basis functions and increase the dimensionality of the configuration. So, and we equalize them. So by this way, we get the optimal representation for this form. The main issue here is that how we anti-symmetrize our wave function, because in Hartree-Fock can be done very easily. But just anti-symmetrizing the coefficient vector, by changing two indices of the two electrons, the wave function will change the sign. Here, the problem occurs, how shall we anti-symmetrize the wave function represented in these spaces? So, but it is just a technical problem. Yes?
I'm confused what this n times omega is
equal to,
and what is n?
So n is the number, the average number of basis function per single particle. And number of configurations is the cumulative, the dimension of this. It tells how many linear combinations we have.
So why should, I
don't understand why. It should be n squared, but not all of them are time are independent because of this anti-symmetrization. So they are, this is the independent part.
Okay, and why isn't the Hartree-Fock the same?
The Hartree-Fock is not the same.
Okay.
Sorry?
Just because you split it differently, you see, you're now having exactly what David Tanner was saying. You're now having S1 and X2, for example, as a group. So now you've got more quasi-particles or adaptive particles, but each in fewer dimensions. So you pay with the larger number of configurations that you need to independently.
So now let's turn to the applications of the MCDH for our model diatomic system. So we choose as a model system, a diatom consists of two nuclei fixed in some distance, and which has two electrons each moves in two dimension. So the parameters are chosen, the nuclear distance and the ionization potential are chosen to be equal to the realistic N2, but principally it is not a N2 molecule, it's an artificial, I call it A2 diatom. So the most optimal representation in MCDAG is that we use here only one-dimensional basis functions. It's still possible because we have four indices, four single particles who can do the propagation in a single processor machines. If we had here six dimensions, which is two three-dimensional electrons, then we had six indices, and this would be quite complicated. Then we had to combine several degrees of freedom into one multi-dimensional, two-dimensional particle. But here is not the case. So we are going to, here is the orbital form is written, but actually the spin is present in the calculation. So we use the fact that the external electric field doesn't change the spin of the system. So initially, symmetric or anti-symmetric orbital stays symmetric in the during the propagation. The question is how to generate the initial symmetric state of the system, and then it will stay symmetric. So the initial state is found by that imaginary time propagation. Yes.
H is what?
H is the time dependent Hamiltonian for the system.
That's on a vector, so how do you have a dot product?
It's a multiplication, so. Okay.
Well, so several words about our model system, why we have chosen such a system. So the main task in our in this talk is to identify the role of the multiple, the excited state of this ion, of this two electron diatom. So here the quantum states are shown here is the really large distance between the ground state of this A2 plus and first excited state, 10.6 AV, and even more for the second excited state. So this is an example prototype of the tightly or strongly bound system. By this way, we want to eliminate the large number of ionic eigenstates which are involved in dynamics, so here only a few states will be included, so it's very easy to analyze. So, now the technical part. We have explicit our represent our wave function in a one-dimensional basis set. Now, the same must be done for the whole Hamiltonian. So the most complicated part is the electron repulsion potential, which is couples all 4 degrees of freedom in this case. I'm using Cartesian coordinates, it's clear. And this can be initially can be represented in the set of two-dimensional potentials very easily. This is the expansion in natural orbitals. So here only few terms, less than 10 terms, are necessary to converge, to get quite good convergence. But if we want to go to the one-dimensional potential to expand each of this potential into the one-dimensional base set, it's very problematic, it's a well-known problem. So it's required too many terms. So we don't do it. We leave it two-dimensional and manage to calculate the matrix elements of these two-dimensional potentials very efficiently. So using the fact that the potential depend on the difference of the coordinates. For example, the matrix elements of this one state is represented in this two-dimensional integral. The second part is two-dimensional, which can be calculated using the convolution theorem, which turns to the calculation of this integral into two Fourier transformations, where the fast Fourier transform can be used, which leads to the much lower numerical scaling than quadratic one. If the scaling is almost linear. So by this way, we eliminate all higher dimensional integration during the propagation, and that's why the method can be really very efficient. But so several words about the computational times. Depending on application, the method shows a different performance. In high harmonic generation applications where most part of the ionization wave function can be absorbed because it doesn't contribute to the harmonic signal, And that's why the grid will be lowered and the correlation between the bound and the continuum parts will be partially eliminated because we have solved the ionization signal. And that's why we can achieve these parameters. It's the intensity, wavelength, and the number of oscillations in a pulse. We can achieve very good accuracy choosing only 15 functions per degree of freedom, which leads to the approximately 4 hours on a single processor machine. But even if we don't absorb anything, we use the full grid, choosing almost 30 functions per degree of freedom. It's for the applications in non-sequential double ionization. This still can be done on a single processor machine. So,
basically, you're replacing the severe approximation that the line motion is independent of.
No, it's not an approximation at all. There is not an approximation at all. Everything is exact.
Well, assuming you have infinite number of configurations.
What do you mean configurations? The bound states?
Many of these
the orbitals, yes. The question is the how good we are converged. So we have observables, say harmonic spectrum, and how good we want to define this. And if I choose, if, for example, here I choose 15 functions and I'm converged better than 10 to minus 6th power. So it means that I can represent, for example, harmonic spectrum with this accuracy. So this everything is exact. It's close, not exact, it's approximation, but it's, the approximation is controlled. It's very close to the exact.
What is capital N?
Capital N is the number of the oscillations in a pulse. We have a 10 cycle pulse, yeah, 2 cycle pulse.
And what's an SDI?
NSDI, non-sequential double ionization. So, non-sequential double ionization, so the ionization, generally.
So this is when you've got both electrons in the end out.
Yeah, in the end out,
as correlated as it could possibly be, given that it's usually one electron comes back, kicks the other electron, and both fly out.
And when you're saying it's non-sequential, this means it's friction-driven. So energy of the photon is not sufficient to ionize
the second electron.
Yes.
Yeah, the energy of the photon there is only 1.5 electrons.
Yeah.
So the only approximation here really is that you're leaving at the third degree of freedom? Can you estimate what the physical...
Yes, it can be. Actually, everything is done within two dimensions exactly, but the question is what will be in the case of...
Little n.
Of the number of orbits.
They do not correspond to the real orbitals.
That's convergence, right?
That's something else. So if we talk about the orbitals, if you think about the quantum mechanical orbitals, these are not, they are time-dependent orbitals. Roughly, they are different linear combinations of the orbitals, which fit to the wave function better.
Making the environment is an approximation.
Yes, approximation, but this approximation is controlled.
Yes, so do you have a comparison to show how it converges?
To the exact result?
How it converges at all? Does it converge when
it converges very well. We have almost exact results. Depending on the accuracy, for example, for both.
Do you have the picture? I think the best way to do it is to show.
I don't have that picture.
Okay, so maybe once Suren is done with the talk, I will pull out the picture where Suren compared the full calculation done, of course, unfortunately. Well, the full calculation is done with two electrons, each in one dimension. But it's a full calculation, no approximations, just run the two-dimensional 10-dependent Schrödinger equation, and Suren calculated the full correlated two-electron spectrum after two-electron ionization.
And then in one dimension?
Each electron in 1D. Because that we can do without any approximations exactly, and then Suren has tested the convergence of this method. With each electron, in this case, limited to one dimension, to the full exact result. And so this is one of the things that we can check. That, yeah,
that doesn't tell you what is the convergence of the two dimensional.
Okay, so what we can do is we can say, okay, we have Suren has clear criteria for convergence. This is the population of natural particles, and we can say that look, in this particular case, which we can verify explicitly, this convergence criterion works, and if the population of the natural orbital number 15 is below 10 to minus 6, we're converged. So then we use the same as a convergence criterion for higher dimensionality. So the population of natural orbital for each dimension is below 10 to minus 6.
One more comment. Can you do helium atom with this technique? Because helium atom at 800 nanometers, it was done by so many people.
So
except it's done by the Ken Taylor.
Ken Taylor.
Only one.
But they're 3D.
Nobody else.
3D.
So many people mean Ken Taylor, Jonathan Parker, Laura Moore, Daniel Dundas, and all of his team.
But they've done it so many times.
And they actually not true.
No. They've done 400 nanometers and 800 is done recently, so 1 year.
So it in Heidelberg at least.
But.
So many times means that in Heidelberg, last October, for the first time, they have been able to present converged correlated to electron spectrum at 800 nanometers. Mm-hmm. This calculation has taken one full week over Christmas on 1,000 processor machine.
Yeah, on 4,000 on a supercomputer. And I'm doing calculation on a single core CPU.
It was three dimensional.
Well, yeah, it was a five-dimensional problem.
It was also done with MCTDH?
No.
It's a brute force propagation.
Not so brute, but quite brute.
But still, how this... Is it anything really physical in this model when it applies to helium? Can you see at least some features?
Oh, pretty much everything.
The physics doesn't change with the dimensionality, of course. We can appreciate everything according to the energy difference, etc., etc. Just there are several things which will be more pronounced in a two-dimensional case as in the case of three-dimensional. For example, the rescattering will be more pronounced in this system because in 3D the electron can escape the ion very much easier. But the principally, if we connect everything with the physical parameters, so everything is present there. So several words about the convergence, because I present here the calculations in 2D, and the people think that if we had a 3D, then that we had to use much more number of basis functions to describe it. This is not true. This principle is not true because in applications where the bound and continuum parts occur, the main correlation goes not within the electrons, but within the packets, the bound part and the ionized part. So that's why the number of the basis functions in the case we have one, two, or three dimensions, it's more or less the same, very close to each other. So this will be the case also in a three-dimensional case, but we have here, instead of four, six dimensions.
So actually, yes, five is enough.
Five is enough, you have an atom more close in a linearly polarized.
Well, I can't hear you.
If you have atom in a linearly polarized field, it's five. If you have molecule in a linearly polarized field along the field along the nuclear axis, it's also five.
You have one good quantum number, which is the m around the axis, the axial axis. So you can fix one electron in a plane, and then the other, of course, you need the azimuthal angle.
Except that if your molecule is rotated relative to laser polarization, then this is fine.
That's right, you can't do it. But I think the point is, you could test this model against an exact three-dimensional calculation, assuming the electric field is along the molecular axis.
Right.
So you test the accuracy of this model against that calculation, and then that gives you some ground to stand on.
You mean they take helium?
No, H2.
Put the electric field along the axis, but do it in three dimensions. Because you have, in three dimensions is trivial, because you have this.
For like one electron or for two electrons?
For two electrons.
You still have axial symmetry.
At 800 nanometers.
You still have axial symmetry.
Well, so that this is sort of, this becomes the Kent-Taylor calculation.
No, but the point is,
but you have a different method.
The third dimension is analytic.
But in helium, it's even easier than in H2, and it takes Kent
1 week.
But you have a different method. You have a different method that you say is much more efficient. So it would be wonderful to test against it.
We are going to do it principally. We are going to apply this for that real three-dimensional problem.
I don't think it's any more numerical work. I mean,
no, it's just waiting.
No. I mean, if the third dimension is analytic, it should not increase.
Tony, if you restrict everything to one electron, then of course that's a trigger, because you take hydrogen atom.
Okay, H2 plus.
H2 plus, hydrogen atom. So then you're comparing effectively two-dimensional exact calculation to a two-dimensional calculation done this way. H2 plus means one active electron. If the laser field is polarized along the axis of H2 plus, you have this axial degree axial symmetry. So effectively you have one particle, two-dimensional kind of Schrödinger equation, which is trivial to solve, and we can solve it this way and we can compare. So what we have done is essentially the same, but with two electrons, one in each dimension. The advantage of choosing the other example that we have chosen is that we have particle-particle interaction. We have other non-trivial dynamics, such as two-electron ionization. And that we have tested thoroughly, and it's beautifully convergent. So perhaps what is really important is to, again, emphasize the criteria for convergence, and then later I promise I will show you the results for that other two-dimensional Schrödinger equation.
I suppose the only point that we're trying to make is that if you were to solve the H2 with two electrons in full three dimensions, with the laser pointing along the axis, it's a five-dimensional problem. And you're solving a four-dimensional problem. So add just one dimension in
your this is quite complicated. It's not so easy. It's not so easy because we have here Cartesian coordinates. And in these coordinates, for example, it's much easier to decouple this potential, the two-dimensional potentials. Then we have what quite complicated, polar coordinates, which it's not possible to do it. So we can couple two, and then the other three, maybe with
combined.
Yeah.
A lot of simplification, whereas in spherical coordinates you lose that. But maybe you could rotate way to a plane.
Maybe. I mean, the suggestion is well taken. I mean,
you can still do Cartesian, but because you know that
have a rotation matrix,
that there's the axis symmetry, so you just put it in a plane and then the
that's
other.
Right.
But I mean,
if we can beat Kent Taylor, then it's a
no.
Goal.
The issue is not what we are saying, it's the information that you are giving us, that actually the convergence is pretty much the same in the three-dimensional case. So we say, okay, if that's the case, why don't you just do it? That's all.
Okay. I mean, how do you represent your orbitals? I mean, you have to represent somehow the orbitals.
Yes.
On a grid,
On a grid. The basis of same, these are point waves.
And the external potential you also have to expand in this product form.
Yes, it is done by the natural orbitals, so to say.
But also for the external potential.
Sorry?
Also
this is numerical.
Not only for the particle-particle interaction, but also for the external potential.
What do you mean by external potential?
Laser field.
Laser field.
No, by the from the nuclei, for instance.
Ah, yes. The nuclei has the same form instead of x minus x three. X one square plus y one squared can be done so in the same way. Okay, then I go ahead. So now the application. So we put our model system with two electrons in a laser field, so with two oscillations, two cycle pulse, and the main task is to see how the excited state of the ionic excited state appear, and to understand where that comes from, how it is pronounced, etc., etc. So now we have here we calculate the ionic state populations, the ionic states. Yeah, the A2 plus states are shown here, ground state and three excited states. The populations is shown here, how we calculate it. So first we take the exact wave function of time t and subtract the all bound spectrum of the two electron complex. And we build this ionization wave function, and then we project on the certain ionic state, the phi I, the ionic state, and this will give the correlated wave function of the other electron, the norm of which will give the probability that the other electron, the one of the electrons, is in some a certain ionic state. So multiplying by two, because we have two electrons, so we get the ionic populations. So what is very important that in this case we see approximately 6% of population of ground state for the first excited ionic state, which is really very too large, because we have chosen quite a strong bound system. It's the excitation energy 10.6 eV and the intensity is 1 times 10 to 14. So this is.
I don't understand what that means. 6% of ground state population.
So this is. I compare the populations. So here, at the end of the laser pulse, we have the population of this state is 6% of this state.
This is the ground state of the ion in the first excited state.
So you're saying that's too high.
Yeah, I said that's too high.
It's not too high. It is,
but it's huge. It's huge, actually.
But it may be a result of the reduced
energy. No. So we're going to study what's the where it comes from.
One question.
So, yes.
The psi m.
The psi m's are the
eigenstate.
Two electron eigenstates. Yes.
From where do you have it?
I have it from the diagonalization of the two electron Hamiltonians. Just using some Lanczos or Davidson diagonalizer. So here the populations beyond in the left of this blue curve are not exact, because there are too many two electron states involved in this time. Because
something very obvious. What is that? When he says the first, when you say the first excited state.
State of the ion. Yeah.
Yes. So what does that mean? That you have 6% of the ground state population when you're
ground state of the ion. 6% of the ground state of the ion. It means that if you ionize your neutral and you create an ion, then 94% will end up in the ground state of the ion, and 6% will end up in the excited state of the ion.
Which is shake up.
And the shake up is not possible. And this is what we were stunned with, right? Because when you think about the fact that you are using 800 nanometer laser field, with a tiny photon energy, mm-hmm. There is no room for shake-up. There is no room, well, Sorrento will tell you. Depends, so okay.
So
it actually is important for the long term.
Yeah, principally the populations are here not so very converged, because there are too many two electron states, bound states, and we do not have it. So, but here we are converged. So
and the blue line is the laser pulse.
This the dotted magenta is the absolute value of the laser pulse. Yes. Okay, now let's analyze where it comes from, and how it is connected to the physical value. So the origins of the ionic excitations, main origins, they are the first. They can be populated by the laser field. While the one of the electrons is in the continuum, the laser field may excite the ion. It's possible. Second, this state can be populated by the electron rescattering. Electron comes back and excites. The other possibility is that tunneling by excited state of the neutral. So excited state of the neutral can be populated by the laser field, and the tunnelization of the one of the electrons will. It is possible that the rest will relax to the ionic state, not only to the ground, ionic state, but also the excited ionic state. These are the main mechanisms. The others, which is shake up, it's very dependent on this energy difference. It's actually negligible. Yes.
Your orbitals allowed you to go to the continuum? I mean, I thought that these were bound state orbitals, but...
No. Everything I'll describe to the continuum. Everything is included, bound state and continuum.
What kind of orbitals do you use for expanding the continuum?
It's plane waves.
And so you discretize the plane waves. I mean, all this detail, I may have missed it, but you didn't say anything about that.
I'm not
the plane waves.
And then no. These orbitals shouldn't mix with the real orbitals. The orbitals per plane waves is just a basis where I represent
it.
So, but the whole this bound states are quite well represented in that basis.
Right. So what happens in the continuum? How do you represent the continuum? That is my question.
The same in the plane wave basis.
On
a grid, you mean on a grid or not?
No, but you're using a basis of orbitals. Are these
I'm using plane waves. It is defined in the whole range. So they represent the bound part and the constant part.
How many of them do you use?
So for this present case, I have chosen about 15 orbitals per degree of freedom. Altogether, 15...
That implies a
discretizing the continuum?
No.
Why not?
Because it's a discretization, but all number of the configurations is 15 to the power 4.
So you have...
I have 15 degrees of freedom, 15 functions per degree of freedom.
Yeah, we understand, but I mean, so you discretize the continuum with 15 functions only.
The continuum, according to one electron is in 2D, is 225.
So you have discrete K-grid. K-grid to represent the continuum states.
Yeah. Did you check that this converges? Because usually...
With respect to the grid, yes.
Not enough a sparse grid for the continuum.
The convergence with respect in a grid is another issue. Actually, these applications are done with the 0.4 atomic unit, which basically is sufficient for this soft core nuclear potential.
Like in random phase calculation, normally I have 15 k-grid points per channel. And
well, it depends on how you want to go in the continuum. Here, it
depends on the photon energy.
Exactly. And he has a lot of above threshold ionization. We know that you have high harmonic generation. That means that you absorb at least
50
20
photons.
Or 30 photons in the continuum.
Yeah, true.
That is an enormous energy, and yet you are able to represent this with only 15 discrete plane waves. That is a surprise.
The maximum momentum is just dependent on grid spacing. Yeah? 0.4 is sufficient to describe the whole spectrum.
Do you have the system in a box? Is that how you do it?
Yeah, system in a box.
How big is your box?
If I remember, for this is about, I have plus minus 200 in the field direction and plus minus 100 in perpendicular direction for these two cycle poles.
And then sorry, what, real space grid.
What is the size of the box?
So
by 100.
Of what? Atomic unit. But you have a wavelength of 800 nanometers.
Yes.
And according to all the models, it's the wave that is, so you have to make huge exertion.
Everything is included. The electron may not escape, may not go more than 200 atomic units for this at this intensity, yes?
Yeah, they don't calculate the oscillation amplitude, it's about 20 more.
It's about 15 or 30 atomic units, the classical oscillations of the electron in this laser field.
200 bars is not 800 nanometers, which is what I think you need if you want to...
You mean you need the box of the size of the wavelength?
Of the wavelength, that's
no,
all your models.
We're working in the dipole approximation. Come on.
It's the question is... Even all the models that you and Paul Kolkam are telling us is that the wave is going up and is moving the electron back and forth.
So the expansion amplitude of the electron.
But the fuel is essentially...
Is 20 bore.
No, but they don't take it to be...
No, the excursion amplitude of the electron is 20
bore. Just 20 bore.
It's 20 bore. So 200 bore is completely sufficient. But I'm missing something.
Okay.
Because
suppose that we only have one electron.
Yes.
Per one dimension. Then your orbitals, you only need one orbital, right? It's one electron in one dimension, you would only need one orbital.
Yes, one function. Yeah.
Which is, of course, there in degree, but it's not a plane wave. And it will not be plane wave in your calculation. Either.
No, it is not. But I have to choose a very good basis, for which it's possible to represent both the bound and continuum parts. And they are not such a good phase functions. That's why I'm using plane waves.
But why do you just
you're not doing a grid like
I represent I'm doing on a grid.
Coordinate space grid.
But now I'm confused. Are you using a real space grid or a K grid?
A space grid.
A real space grid. Yes. And where's then the K?
Why do you call that a plane wave?
Plane waves can be represented in the grid also. What's the problem?
No, there's no problem. You can be both, but the question is, there is once when you ask where you represent it, you said in a K?
No, not in a K. I don't say that I represent in a K. I do everything on a grid.
Okay. His orbit is independent.
Yeah, it's a basis.
How do you represent bound states?
I do the relaxation in imaginary time. I choose the initial guess state and just leave to the relax. I found it.
Not yeah.
Only continuous plane.
But I'm not even sure I understand about the planes.
No, there are no plane waves, as I understand. You represent everything on a real space grid with a fixed grid spacing. There are no plane waves.
But what surrenders is...
I'm talking about the basis functions, not the grid.
So
you're talking about the grid?
Your orbital is time dependent.
Yes.
Your orbital is time dependent. So if you only have one electron in one dimension, then this wave function starts bound, because it's not a plane wave, it evolves, it does something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still not a plane wave, but it's still one function. Could be very complicated, it's still one...
That's single configuration.
One single configuration.
No, it's not a single configuration.
No, one electron in one dimension.
Okay.
Now that's a single wave function. It's a single
and what it is?
It's a time-dependent wave function. Okay.
It's a time-dependent wave function. Right?
Yes.
So your orbitals, which you derive, are also time-dependent.
Yes.
So what would in this case, you only have one configuration, or would you still have many? This is what I'm missing. I think you would only have one.
Oh, in what case?
One electron in one dimension.
I have only one function as numerical exact propagation.
Right. So then what about the plane waves? I'm
just represent everything. I have a time-dependent basis. So, okay, forget about the plane waves. Plane waves. Just they are time-dependent basis functions. They are found by the equations of motion, but just they are represented in the plane waves. So
for doing the
I have a primitive basis representation for each of these time dependent bases.
The orbitals. You have.
Why would you need them?
You have the orbitals. So to say that can you go back one slide, please? In your expansion, there you have the phi J1, phi J2, phi J3, and so on, depending on coordinates. And this changes in time, that you have to represent somehow on the computer. And that you have also to expand in time independent.
But you put it on the grid, then that's it.
Yes, exactly. But that's the question. Do you put it on a real space grid or on a or plane waves? How do you expand these?
I see. Okay.
It's a little bit confusing because, so to say, you have two expansions. You have an expansion in time dependent basis, and you have to expand again in a time independent basis.
You can expand, cannot expand.
It's a question of semantics. If we go back to the early 1980s, the papers called on what's called the Fourier method. In the Fourier method, you take your initial wave packet, you use an evenly spaced grid, you represent it as a set of amplitudes there, you calculate the operation of the Hamiltonian on this at each of the grid points, and you evolve this thing in time. Now because sometimes it's a discrete grid of points in which you're representing the wave function. Sometimes people like to say that this is using a plane wave basis, because when you do the Fourier transform to calculate the kinetic energy, you're representing it in the Fourier space, and then that's a momentum representation. So is that the sense in which you mean you have a plane wave basis?
I just want to say that you can use it just in a grid, but you can also expand it in a plane waves.
Yeah, but it is
done to calculate efficiently the kinetic energy operator.
Or if you have...
Because transform to the plane basis, calculate, multiply by the p square, and then transform back.
So that's the sense in which it's a plane wave basis.
Yeah. So, okay. Yes. Now, let's see. I was talking about these are the three main origins of the excitations. And let's see if the electric field can excite the ionic state from ground to the excited one. So for this purpose, we do one electron calculation. It's the ion taking initially in the ground state and putting in the same field, and see what happens with the population of this state. It just repeats the field, the intensity. Yes, of course, this population is not real. It's a virtual population, which is the same as the polarization of the ionic ground state. But nevertheless, if everything include, even this virtual population, it doesn't exceed 2%. So it means that the field cannot be, in this case, the source of the excitation of this state. So next, let's turn to the third possibility, the tunneling by excited states of the neutral. So let's see how the excited state of the neutral are populated. So it's the same calculations, and here is shown the population of the excited two electron states, excited states of the neutral here, the ground state and first eight states are put the one electron density, and their populations. So here again, this represents the field. So what we see here that the everything mostly copies the field. It means that it's the virtual excitation, it's the polarization of the ground state of the neutral. But after some point where the field reaches the maximum, there's a real population transfer between these states. Yes?
Now I'm confused again as to how you get away with basis expansion of 15 orbitals, because here you're including the ground state plus eight excited states. Does that mean
as for one electron
states,
for one
six states are in the continuum?
So I have enough basis to represent all of them, because I use 15 wave functions but per 1 degree of freedom. So total configuration space is 15 times the fourth power. It's enough. It's enough to represent the very large number of bound states plus the continuum part. Even if I focused on the bound states, I would say that less than 10 terms per degree of freedom will be necessary. The rest I need for the ionization part.
Fundamental motion for one electron, you have like six orbitals in the continuum.
No.
You said 15 is the basis. So here you have ground state, eight excited states. That's nine.
But this is two electron excited states.
For two electron excited states.
There's very little excitation for each electron.
I see.
So, what we see that the population of these excited states is quite low, but in reality, the ionization of the and the population of the ionic states is in the same range. So, it is possible that the field excites these states, and the tunnel ionization of this state will lead the population not only the ground ionic state, but the excited ionic states. So to analyze it, we just do the same calculation, but choosing initially the neutral, not in the ground state, but in some excited state, and applying the same field So we'll see what is happening with the ionic population. Here actually it's not the same. Yeah, it is not the same field. Here we have added some ellipticity in the field. This ellipticity is very important because it kills the rescattering of the electron. Electron is not returned to the ion, but it's returned from far away, so the scattering may not is very reduced. So what we see mostly is a tunnel ionization from this to electron state, which mostly populates the ionic ground state. So nothing, almost nothing in the ionic excited state. If we take the other two electron states, the same, the similar picture will appear, which means that for the present case, this mechanism also cannot be as a source of the population of ionic states, so higher states. So principally, this is just for the present case, because here we have large difference gap between the ionic ground and first excited states. So that's why if we want that this mechanism works, then we should have a certain excited two-electron state, which means that both electrons in a two-electron complex, bond complex must be excited, which means that these states are energetically very high enough. So I don't understand if I explained correctly. Maybe I write something. For example, it is ionic states. It's ground and first excited. So in orbital picture, it is visible or not? In the orbital picture, the ground state of the neutral is that two electrons in this ground state. Then all these states here, they represent one of the electrons here and second electron in some other higher states. It is clear that if we tunnel ionize this electron, the rest will go to the ionic ground state, of course. If you want that the tunnel ionization of the two electron states populate the higher ionic states, then both electrons must be in excited states. So then we can tunnelize this one, and this will populate, will relax also to the ionic excited state. But such two electron states are really very high, high excitation energy, because just this energy gap between ground and ionic state is 10.6 eV is too large. And that's why they are not populated in the present case, and that's why we don't have this mechanism for the working. But principally, if we have realistic 3D multi-electron systems, where this gap is quite small, for example, in an N2 molecule, it's N2 plus as the gap of about several electron volts. So such a state can be populated, and this mechanism can work. I mean, the decay, the tunnel ionization of these states can populate the ionic excited states. But as I said, for the present case, it's not the case. So then what we have finally is the last mechanism, electron rescattering. Principally, it is possible because according to classical mechanics, maximum return energy is about 18 eV, so it's possible to do. So what we want, how we want to analyze, we add some ellipticity in the field, and we keep the field intensity in the X direction intact and add some perpendicular part, so and see what happens with the populations. So with the 0.2 ellipticity, the ionization is enhanced because ionization is the intensity is enhanced, but simultaneously the population of this first excited state goes down. We may go up, and what is happening in this small part shown here? Here is the line with zero ellipticity, 0.2, 0.4, and 0.6. So it is clear that the whole excitation here is coming from the electron rescattering. This is a very important point because this process, this is just neglected in all applications. It's assumed that it's not taken into account. And we see here that even for this very strong bound system, there's significant population and the, which is coming for the rescatter.
Why are you saying this process was neglected in all applications?
Because in all applications, the more generation. Yes. In also question double ionization, of course, the electron kicks, it is included. Yeah, sure. Sorry. So, okay. Yes. What the.
How much of an effect does it have on the harmonics?
Sorry?
How much of an effect does it have on the harmonics?
How much is effect in high bar harmonics? So, I'll talk it about that later.
So well, you have about 10 minutes, so try to.
Okay.
Smith's conclusion that if you go back to the previous slide, it shows that the population is 0.6%, or 0.5%, between 0.5% and 0.6%. But earlier you said that the excited state was 6%.
6%.
Here is the same 6% of the ground state population.
Of the ground state
population. Yeah, we are comparing the populations. So we ionize it and okay.
In the ground state should be close to one. So
no, it's the ionization. The population of the ionic states. The sum of this one plus the excited states gives the ionization probability.
The units there are 0.006, which I take to be a probability.
Yes. Ionization probability.
0.6%. Earlier you said it was 6%.
No.
6% of this ratio of this ground state population. Ratio, it's about 16 times less, so let's say that this one, in this case. Okay. Yes, we have found that the electron wave scattering is the main mechanism for the excitation for this A2 diatom. Now let's, what can we conclude? So. It is logically can think that this effect will for the high laser intensities will be much more pronounced because the electron maximum energy scales linearly with the intensity. So, and moreover, this effect will be more pronounced for the realistic multi-electron systems because for them this energetic difference is much lower, so it's much easier to excite it. It means that. Generally, if you go to for the multi-electron systems, that single active electron approximation will be not valid for it. It means that the electron correlation will be present and will be present very very good. So, yes. Okay, that was everything for the. Yes. Okay. Now let's analyze how is the dependence of this electron ray scattering process on the other variable. So we have found now the dependence on this energetic this difference between the quantum states and the maximum return energy. Now let's see how is the dependence, for example, on the Lauser pulse duration. We had the calculation with the 2-cycle pulse. Now we have the 4-cycle pulse. Will this excitation increase or lower? So again, we see the substantial population even more than in the case of 2-cycle pulse, so it is still present, doesn't go away. The other thing is the molecular orientation. So we put the laser field perpendicular to the molecular axis direction and see how is the same scattering effect pronounced. So what we see here, the population of the is dropped but two times in this case. So this is also possible to explain if we go inside of these molecular orbital shapes. For if the electric field is in the direction of the molecular axis, then the population goes from this state to this state. And this state is very weak pronounced because of this perpendicular symmetry. If we have the perpendicular direction, the field goes the perpendicular direction, then the transition from this state to this state will be lowered. And this state will be activated. So this is the second excited state. But transition to this state is very weak because the energetically it is too high. And that's why the transition from this state just generally will be decreased. So in this sense that we have found another dependence, just it depends on orbital shape. the precisely said that the transition matrix element between the electronic states.
What is the dependence on ellipticity in this case?
Ellipticity, the ellipticity kills it, because the scattering disappears, yeah, gradually with the increasing ellipticity, and nothing occurs for the present case. So the effect is very strong. Actually, it's really very strong. If you go to the realistic systems, it will be very large, and that's why it's very important. So now I'll talk about the application to the harmonic generation, so to see what is the role of this high excited ionic states in, for example, harmonic signal. So do the harmonic application for a 10 cycle pulse in intensity 1 times 10 to 14 watt per centimeter square. And before going forward, so we do exact calculation. We have there is some theory here developed which allows us to extract the information of the role of different ionic states in harmonic emission process. We call it as ionic eigenstate result harmonic generation. So firstly, we project our excited wave function from the numerical calculation to a certain ionic state, get that. correlated wave function of the other electron, and then we build such symmetrizing this, we'll get so to say this wave function will define the one of the electrons in a certain ionic state, and summing up over the m states, we'll get this m function will represent the cumulative role of the first m ionic eigenstate in dynamics process. And if we calculate the harmonic spectrum taking this function, then we'll show us the contribution of the first m ionic states in the harmonic signal. So we'll go in a following way. We'll take first the ionic ground state and see how it obtains some value. And then we'll add gradually the other states, and we'll see how it converges to the exact results. So by this way, we can analyze how big is the role of the excited ionic states. So according to this methodology, the harmonic emission is represented in different channels. They correspond not only to the ionic excited ionic bound states, but also we have a direct emission and exchange emission. So direct emission can be simplified as the conversion to the Dyson orbital here. So okay, just in several words, we have developed a theory which extracts the information about different ionic states and the direct exchange parts in harmonic emission. And now, let's analyze it. The harmonic generation can be really divided into two regions, where the so-called two-cent interference is valid or not. So two-cent interference is just that the returning it depends on how much of the half wavelength of the returning electron fits into the molecular distance in the field direction. And if this interference, which is the interference of the harmonic signal created by one core and the other core, is destructive, then we get such a picture, which is that the certain harmonics are just eliminated, they cancel. And if it's constructive, we get a maximum. So, and this is just a destructive case for the, this effect depends on the recombination state. If the symmetry of the recombination state is changed, then the ordering of the destructive and constructive is also changed. So it's very important to say that in our methodology, only the direct channels corresponding to the different ionic state will be included in two-cent interference. So we have such a minimal or maxima. The exchange part doesn't have anything, has no structure. Now let's analyze the role of the ionic excitations in a region where the two-cent interference is valid or not valid. Because it's very important, because if the two-cent interference is valid, then we have the minimum, and of course, the first for example, for the first ground iron state has a minimum and the excited states will play a role. The question is how much is the role. But if we don't have this two-sided interference, then everything which plays a role is just the weight of this excited ionic state, which is here at 45 degrees of molecular alignment, the two-sided interference not present, shifted here. And what we see here is the ratio between the exact harmonic yield and the harmonic yield taking on the ground state is average, it's at 10%, which means that the ground state, the weight of the other excited state is about roughly 10%. This is just the corresponds to the weights of this excited ionic states. But this 10%, which we have found, can be really very crucial if we have a two-sided interference. For example, at 15 degrees of molecular alignment, here what we see, the harmonic yield taking cold the ground state, it's a black curve, has a well-defined minimum, it's a destructive ionization, the destructive interference. So. But taking the other states, the blue one is the exact one, this effect is lowered. Here's the difference is about three times, which is the huge factor. Okay, the situation is very dramatic if we have linear molecular alignment. Here the opposite picture is seen, that taking on the ground state we have quite somehow defined geometrical minimum, which is comes from the destructive ionization, destructive interference. But taking the other states, we have more deeper minimum, and this is just the. I don't think I have time, so but this is just due to the not due to the two-sided interference. This is comes due to the interference of the different channels, which represent the harmonic generation.
Even in atoms, you see these oscillations in the harmonic spectrum. So not all of the oscillations can be due to the two-sided.
Of course, but this is just from the two-sided interference. We know it. Yeah. So the difference is about four times in this region, and this means that the single actor electron approximation, it means taking on the ground state, is very coarse approximation. Now let's take the case, this case. Case of linear molecular alignment, and see how the behavior of the different channels in the harmonic emission process.
Maybe now we should stop at this point, unless someone
okay.
Wants.
Okay. Yeah.
What kind of question? The effect of the excitation of bound electrons, it in principle, is also there in high harmonic generation from atoms, right? The effect of excitation of bound electrons in high harmonic generation is in principle is also there in atoms.
Not really, because the spacing between ionic states is much higher.
But in alkaline atoms, it's a lot.
So has it been studied there?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. So what's new here is to study this in the case of molecules.
Well, Nothing
is new. Just we have here two datums where these two-sided interference may appear, and there the population of higher states may be very important, much more important than in case of the atoms. But principally it is nothing
new. In the sense that you get radiated transitions to different states.
It's to the same ground state, simply via different ionic channels. Exactly as Ruby described it.
So the thing is that in high atomic generation, in fact, there are more works that would consider multiple channels leading via different ionic states. The same ground state.
Or
the effect of ionic states on the harmonic generation was actually never considered before our work. And maybe what you recall is the coherence position of states in the neutral, and that also two different channels. But these are different situations. You have to prepare coherence propositions of the state of the neutron with your, for example, pump pulse, and then with your pro pulse, future wave harmonic, and you have this double channel. Now you just start from the ground state of the neutron, and you analyze and you use these different channels during the ionization process. And what I thought was very interesting in that setup is that harmonic record the relative phase between those different channels going via different ionic states. And they will record all these interactions, various interactions, about which Soren was talking and I was talking. And presently there is no way of calculating this relative phases between channels, because we don't have so far ideas for calculating relative phases between different ionization channels in ionization, because we were always calculating rates, ionization rates.
Now you're talking about molecules.
The simple atoms. When we calculate thermal ionization, we calculate rates. We don't know the phase of ionization. So that really poses the question about the phase of ionization.
But in one electron systems like alkaline atoms, everything is known.
In one electron system, if you have really one electron, there is no such channels. Because you remove electron, you just have...
I see. So as long as you freeze the core, so you have to unfreeze the core, and then you will have this coherence effect.
That's completely new. Absolutely new.
I seem to recall some papers by Ostrovsky. They may have been in collaboration with Lars Madsen, in which they considered harmonic generation with emission to excited states. And the point was that
emission to excited states of the neutral.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned.
That's not coherent because it's not the same frequency as the music.
Yes. So, because there is no, unless you establish a phase coherence between the ground state of the neutral and the excited state of the neutral, you will not have phase matching.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that you never observed.
Yeah.
Right. Well, here, because you start with the ground state of the neutral, you return to the ground state of the neutral, and you have complete phase coherence. Whatever ionic states you are participating, all of this is phase coherence.
So you're saying the ionic states here participate virtually?
No, really, they're really talking about it by different mechanisms. What is probably not... No, you start looking at the Schrödinger equation, you start with the ground state of the neutron. You evolve it to a wave function. Whatever happens to it is fully phase coherent. Whatever populations in the ionic states are created, while the first electron is doing something, or when it comes back, whatever, it's fully phase coherent.
But it radiates
into the ground state, back into the ground state of the neutron.
Okay. So where do the ionic states
go? You remove electron, you can leave ion in the ground state. That would be one pathway. You can leave ion in the excited state, that will be another pathway.
But then it comes back.
But when it comes back, they excite as well.
I see.
You return to the ground state of energy.
But is it clear, is there a clear definition what is the ionic state and what is the neutral state? Because this whole thing takes place in a strong laser field and so on. I mean, what is a highly excited Rydberg state and what is an ionic state? You cannot read.
Yeah,
it's still
in this sense, it's virtual because
no.
Measure is the initial state and the final state. You can't measure when the laser's not
on. In that sense, it is virtual. In that sense, yes.
But in the reality, it's real populations.
Yes. So you can always do a very simple thing. You can always look at the end of the pulse. And with a slight ellipticity, you will have no recombination. So this is what whatever population is left is real, right? Or you can have linearly polarized pulse and you simply detect electron and the ion, not the radiation. And again, whatever is left in the excited state of the ion is real.
May I address just your question? The philosophy, how I think about it, is that I have the basis of the ionic states and correlated continuum electrons. This is my basis.
But this is exactly the point. If you define your basis like that, then so to say you have introduced the definition, isn't it?
Yes, I did. That's what I have did. I introduced the definition. And this basis is complete, and I can think in terms of this basis. However, this basis can be as far as from reality as it is. That means that there is a coupling between my basis states. Means they are not ideal states. Means I don't have real mastery. I have all the complexity. I have couplings between them. I have phases introduced. I have amplitudes, which depends on time. And what is, I think, really cool is that during, if you think in this basis, during harmonic generation, you have these channels associated with the different basis states. And after the process, the harmonic generation process complete, you record it in the amplitudes and phases of your in the amplitude and phases of the basis states, you recorded the evolution of your system. And if you have access to this quantities from harmonic generations, and you do have the access to relative phases and relative amplitudes, then you basically watch the dynamics of your system in this basis. If you don't care in which phases you watch the dynamics, unless you know amplitudes of the of these basis states. So that's really the, how I think about it. And what I think you can actually record, you even can record your arrangement, because this is the system of states of your neutral. This is the system of states of your ion. When electron is far away, you are in the this is the good ion state. When electron is here, nothing happened. This is good ion state. When your electron in between, you have strong couplings, and that tells you that it's not good system. But once you recorded these couplings, you really record the rearrangement. You record how they go from here to here. And that's what we have in our numbers. And that's what I think why it works, actually.
Isn't this like the, you know, in above-threshold ionization, there are these resonances that Freeman found, and aren't they ionic excitations also?
No, they're Rydberg excitations.
Rydberg, okay. I mean, but we know in strong field that it's very difficult to distinguish between Rydberg, high Rydberg, and ionic states.
No, it's
not in Freeman resonances, no, because in Freeman resonances you detect... Yeah, it's multi-photon resonances. You detect one free electron. And
I said in above threshold ionization.
Yes.
Right, so you detect it in the electronic spectra. But so on the way up, the system was aided by these intermediate resonances.
Of the neutron. Of the neutron.
Well,
it's, yes. It's
do we know that?
It's not be seen in harmonics because of
that. That will not be seen. No, no.
But why won't it be seen in harmonic? That's my question. Because
resonance states time typically modern period, and harmonic is subcycle process. So you, to build up female resonance, you would probably need modern period.
So the way I think about.
And the harmonics, you say?
In harmonics, you can even have half cycle.
You can, but I mean, you can still generate harmonics with
important that harmonic is really happens on half cycle. It doesn't matter how many cycles you have. Everything which matters is the time elapsed from ionization to recombination.
Right, and that can be longer than half cycle.
Three-quarters of the cycle, but not, and if you look only at the short trajectories, then this is really half cycle.
So of course you repeat the process again and again and again, but
you throw
have
away,
not,
you, throw away
you have no chance of building Freeman resonance, which means that you don't have a chance of removing an electron and then getting it trapped on the Rydberg orbit for substantial time. Because that's what Freeman resonance is. You remove an electron, even by coupling, then, because there is a core left behind, it captures electron on the orbit. I can show you classical pictures. And this electron wobbles around for substantial time. So that's the Riemann resonance in classical terms. But that really is a picture that only arises over many, many cycles. And if then, after making many round trips, the electron recombines to the ground state, of course you would emit harmonic, but it will not phase match. Because these clever experimentalists, they really look only at those trajectories that spend at most 3/4 of the cycle. And there are heroic efforts now where people finally see contributions of trajectories that spend about a cycle and a half in the continuum. And this is really heroic. The longer the electron spends in the Rydberg state or in the continuum, it doesn't matter. The larger is the phase accumulated by the electron, because the larger is the action. And that, of course, is very sensitive to intensity, as Riemann resonances are. And so then it does not phase match, because in focal volume, you have many different intensities. You have, therefore, large changes of phase across the focal volume, and there is no phase match.
But besides, I think that Moshe Graf is right in the sense that why multi-photon regime, you can actually if there is in the neutral, if system is such that in the neutral is a state which is not very far, not very far separated from the ground state, you can see such a channel which you go by intermediate state, and that would introduce extra phase into this channel, which is probably not very likely in tunneling regime, but could happen in deeply multi-photon regime. But this would not rule out the other ionic channels. That would be just a very unpleasant mix of everything, I would say. Maybe pleasant.
Just one quick question. Maybe I missed that, but the problem with the anti-symmetry of the wave function, how do you solve it in the end, that you just anti-symmetrize by...
We propagate the orbitals, and it means we have symmetric orbitals with respect to the electron change. It means that the spin part is anti-symmetric, so the spin part is not changed in the field.
Okay.
So
okay.
It stays the symmetric, orbital stays symmetric, so it is somehow summed over the spin. Everything.
So the anti-symmetry is just shifted to the spin part and thrown away, so to say.
Let me just ask one more question. I know it's getting late, but if you go back to the very beginning of the formalism of the MCTDH,
mm-hmm.
you just go back then just for a second. Next slide. Okay. Yeah. This term, which is the 1 minus p term, rho h.
This one.
Yeah. So this is what turns it into a nonlinear, actually kind of a nonlinear Schrodinger equation.
With respect to the phi's, yeah.
Yeah.
The phi is present here, and the a's
right.
is present here and here.
Yeah. And so. Michael and I have been arguing about this or discussing this the last for a while. This seems like there's a paradox with this whole method because you for convergence you want 1 minus p to go to 0.
Yes.
Right?
Roughly,
so precisely where this term is important is precisely where you're not converged. So I guess the question is how important is this term? Is it a 5%? Is it a 5% correction?
Depends how many functions you have. For example, look at this case. This is just the convergence in my higher harmonic generation calculation. So here it says that using here only 15 wave functions, the wave function is represented better than 10^-6 power. So it means that we're close to the exact wave function. We're very close to the exact wave function.
So, that I understand. I understand that piece goes to zero when you get enough basis functions.
Yes.
But I guess the question is, when you don't have enough basis functions, is that piece useful?
This formalism?
Yeah. When you don't have enough basis functions, when 1 minus p is large, then is that piece a useful correction?
But what can you choose else? So, of course, we will not good approximation, and what can be done, I don't know. Just it means that you are not converged with respect to the orbitals, but nevertheless, it's much better to have time-dependent orbitals than time-independent, because this is much better. This fits to the system much better. I don't know what can be done else if you don't choose this way. It means that you don't want to choose MCDH for the propagation.
You could also just choose the time dependence of the orbits just by the single particle part of your Hamiltonian. That you could also do.
Oh, sorry, I couldn't understand.
If you just
you need to integrate it approximately, not
work in a time-dependent basis.
Yes.
That the time dependence is just given by the evolution of according to the single particle Hamiltonian.
Okay, let's
no, we can all stay for the private discussion.
Misha, I wanted to show a picture.
People can see those.
Yes.
And what is the expansion of the particle-particle interaction? How large you go up there with the S?
It's about 10 functions.
Really? But this is really, that's not much.
That's not much. This because is from the Schmidt orthogonalization theorem.
Yes, but NEST and so on, I mean, there are papers where they, I don't know, it depends on the precision that you want to do, but there they go up to 100 for the Kuhnau potential.
No, if you want to expand this one into one separate basis, then you have to choose a little very, very large. No, which is doing the screening. But this is some other thing. These are coupled here much more intensely.
But you have to do it for the external potential from the nuclei.
The same, I have to do it here.
Yeah. Yes, but there you do it really with the Coulomb. And there you have to go to high order.
No, it's not Coulomb. It has the same form. Here stays x1 instead of this minus. Here I have x1 square, y1 square, and here I have x1 and y1. It goes to directly the one-dimensional basis. This is the same expansion. If you have a Coulomb potential here, instead of 2 dimensions, I have 1 dimension.
Yes. But why is it different from how large strings he has to go?
Because he wants to expand this one into 1 dimensional basis set. This is very complicated to do. Mm-hmm. And I do not do it. I calculate it exactly, but very efficiently in other way.
Ah, okay. Yeah. No. I mean, it's just the plus and the minus that makes this huge difference.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Okay. But the other point is that in Arden's calculations, the number of orbitals that he uses
is very, very low.
4 or 6 at most.
I think there are calculations with, I don't know.
With 2 or 3 dimensional functions.
I don't know, 10, 15, I think. But it's
I've never seen 15.
Also with Thomas Babbage, where they compare the double ionization with the exact 1D. Schrodinger equation.
And then they are not converged.
They are
still not converged.
They are in this calculation.
With
the MCDH.
I don't remember, but
so can you repeat the question?
I don't remember exactly to how high they go up in this paper.
In the main configurations.
Where there's this paper, I don't know, in which journal, of Armin Skinzi and Thomas quadrature, they do this in 1D, and they compare the exact solution.
5 years ago.
Yes, yes, I remember, but the number I don't remember. Actually, it was more than 10.
Yes.
But it was one-dimensional electrons.
Okay. I remember from GME that was going up to.
But this is still not sufficient. If we have high intensities, for example, 2 times 10 to 14, you have to choose more than 25 functions. Because, we have the...
And especially this is, so to say, the nice scaling that you have in the number of orbitals. The problem is in the number of particles. There you have the bad scaling, the exponential one. And that's, so to say, the scaling in the number of orbitals, that's not so bad.
What do you mean, not bad?
I mean, if you want to apply it, so to say, not only to two electron systems, but
yeah, then to three electrons.
Then this is really what kills you: the particle scaling with the particle numbers and not the orbitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. If that third electron is active, then
as CI, and you do not solve the exponential wall with this method.
So the only chance, I think, is really to use the basis set for the ion. I feel that there's just if you want to go to big systems, there is no other approach but to say, let's identify essential states in the ion. And let's solve a problem in set of coupled Schrödinger equations, each state of the ion, and correlated three-dimensional electronic leukemia.
So close coupling.
Close coupling. And this is the only, approach, viable approach that I see. Just there's nothing else.
And then can you show me again the other way you slide? With the energies, with the excitation energies of the
I'm not to leave.
I have to leave in a few minutes.
Uh-huh.
But let's just
excitations in the neutral.
This one is
something. Yeah. Michal?
No.
Just before I forget, can you send Anatoly our I guess we have two preprints at this point that you can send him. Mm-hmm. Or you can send just the one, I guess.
Yes.
Anything just to trigger.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's not much involved. I mean, it's just the control of the state-to-state transition. But there's nothing wrong here so much.
So maybe you just give some indication what you actually want to achieve, and then.
Okay. But email him a copy, and then we'll
stream. You also have it. So if you like what you want to do, you can also attach the one.
Okay.
I'll just post it on your website.
So please,
This is the population of dust.
Yes, yes. But Galileo is highly non-trivial.
You mean the diagonalization? Yes. This four-dimensional.
Exactly,
yes. No, I do it in a coarse grid. I do it in a coarse grid and do it.
You can still say these are.
Yeah, because they are very close, and it is possible to diagonalize.
I'm still on the grid because the grid is, so to say, four-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. But it's possible. So, for example, 100.
Yes, I'd like to say.
No. About 60 or 70 degrees of 64 degrees, 64 points. It's possible to diagonalize the four-dimensional Hamiltonian on normal machine, but we have a large machine that 128 can choose also. I'm not converged in this sense, because in this area.
Can you come on? Have a slide of the very
first. Doesn't make it. I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So what happens if the car breaks down? It's not your car.
Right, this is the state of the ion.
Hopefully it's somewhere.
A2 plus, and this is A2. The exact states.
Okay.
The bound states.
Okay.
Which state is this?
It is the I. Come on, more something.
What
does
the first is the ground state of the ion. 2 is the it's such a these are the
Einsteins of the
iron. No.
Because it's
H2. H2, I can do it. Okay. You have to calculate also with the diagonalization and relaxation, etc., etc.
And the problem is really that this thing, in some sense, this again, this is definition for the. This is the simplest definition for the ionization of the wave function. We have the problem that in principle the M is large, and if you have a larger system, then calculating these is practically not possible. You see what I mean? That would be nice if one could find a formula for this.
No, it's not possible because the states are involved are too many. For example, here you see. Even here we are not converged, and if we take it into account, there are very, very large amount of states here.
Yes, and
it's not possible. They are still present there, but how to calculate them is the other problem. But this is just a technical problem. Maybe if we have calculate them, then so we can analyze the populations in the field, so to say.
Okay.
Okay, well.
So that makes such a large difference with the plus or minus in the Coulomb.
I don't want
because
to.
Once, so to say, once you expand, if I understand correctly, once you expand x minus y square, and then you need many, or you x square plus y square. That's the difference.
Yes.
This,
if I have such a potential.
You need a huge expansion.
Huge expansion.
You need a small expansion.
Yeah, of course. This is the fact. Yeah. This is very good.
I believe you, but it's
very bad.
Can I understand it?
How?
Is there an easy thing how to understand it?
Understand it. This is just the mathematical. You can understand that.
And this can never diverge, for instance. Yes, both are zero.
Yeah, you put it here something, the soft core thing, and why it is so that the coordinates in this case, we have just a Gaussian type of, they are not very good connected with each other, and here, this is the real coordinate is that x minus y and not x and y. If you put it here, I don't know. This is will be such a thing in both directions, and this is where x and y will be how it will be. It will direct it in this direction. Okay, to this in this direction. So somehow so.
So
the coordinates here are much more coupled.
Yes.
Than here.
Okay.
So the real coordinate is here, the x minus y, and here is x. So this is just the fact that this is just the case.
Okay. Good.
That's why I'm using actually the Cartesian coordinates, because here we have
Okay. And the other expansion you don't do because this you can do via fast Fourier. Simply.
Yes, yes.
That's how you avoid the... That's how you avoid the...
Two-dimensional degrees.
Expansion.
Okay.
I mean, one problem is what I think is if you go to more electron systems, is it then still a
very screwed?
No, the correlation is very large.
But then, can you still do this trick with the, I guess, yes.